This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, President Clinton moves to reduce sulfur in gasoline and make sport utility vehicles meet the same pollution standard as cars. Children's asthma should be reduced. The most significant environmental achievements of the 20th century are listed by the Wilderness Society. A Great Lakes, Michigan blizzard causes college kids to celebrate survival in their heated house, while older ladies defy the storm and collect money for charity. The environment is no threat to those who do God's work. And on the Earth calendar, the first lunar eclipse of the century will tell us how clear the air is here on Earth. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Any of us who've ever been in a hospital delivery room know that when a baby comes into the world, the first thing that's done is to make sure the infant can draw its first breath. As we embark on the new millennium, among all of our other responsibilities, surely it is our sacred obligation to ensure that each and every child, from the first breath on, will be drawing the cleanest, purest, healthiest air we can provide.
With those words, President Clinton announced at the Murray Elementary School in Washington, D.C., new rules covering exhaust from sport utility vehicles, minivans, and pickup trucks, as well as the sulfur content of gasoline. Rules which he said are necessary since we're driving more miles in more vehicles than ever before. And half the new vehicles sold today are pickups and utilities, which produce 3 to 5 times as much pollution as the average passenger car. That's because they've had an exemption under the Clean Air Act.
First, we're setting tough new standards that over the coming decade will reduce tailpipe emissions as much as 95%. Second, for the first time, we are applying the same stringent standard to cars and to sport utility vehicles, including the largest models. And third, because cleaner fuels also are critical to achieving cleaner air, we're cutting the sulfur content of gasoline by up to 90%.
Carol Browner, administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, says the new standards are designed to halt a growing public health problem for children.
Across this country, children's hospitals face an ever-growing number of asthma patients. In the last 15 years, children under 5 have experienced a 160% increase in asthma rates.
Ned Zechman, who is president and CEO of the Children's National Medical Center, thinks improvement of air quality will have substantial results.
We also believe that efforts to improve the environment, particularly the quality of the air, will not only improve the quality of life for the child that suffers from asthma, but is also critical to reducing the number of children in the future that may develop symptoms of asthma or other respiratory diseases.
The reduced vehicle emission requirements are to be phased in beginning with the 2004 model year. All cars will have to comply by 2007 and SUVs and trucks by 2009. The 90% sulfur reductions in gasoline, which will reduce sulfur content to 30 parts per million, must be in effect by 2006. The president's action comes after a running battle that has been going on for years between public health and environmental advocates, the auto industry, and the oil companies. The automakers wanted even lower sulfur standards. Less sulfur in gas means catalytic converters are more efficient, which means fewer changes would have to be made in existing vehicle designs to reduce emissions. They say the new standards will raise sticker prices by $100 to $200. Not surprisingly, the oil refiners say taking more sulfur out of gas requires capital investment which small refiners cannot make, and gas prices could go up as much as a nickel a gallon. They argue air pollution should be curbed by cleaning up power plants. The environmental and health communities wanted tougher standards and sooner implementation for both vehicles and gasoline. but they give the president and his administration high marks for having taken action. Conservative members of the Congress have traditionally opposed stricter vehicle standards, but the new standards are being supported by at least one influential and moderate Republican. Representative Sherwood Bollert from New York's 23rd District is chair of the Water Resources and Environment Subcommittee of the House Committee on Transportation.
And I've already called the White House to talk to the legislative liaison team down there to pass along my commendation. I'm applauding this initiative because I think it's vitally important for America's families. Our kids are suffering a much higher degree of asthma incidents. The American people expect us to protect the air we breathe and the water we drink, and I think this is action that's along the right lines.
The president identified the creation of cleaner diesel fuel as the next big challenge in reducing air pollution from vehicles. It can be anticipated that the players will probably line up on the same sides to contest the change. But David Smith, Director of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for the Atlantic Richfield Company, or ARCO, says his company, on an experimental basis, has produced a batch of diesel with 10 parts per million of sulfur, in contrast to a national average of around 350. ARCO is running a one-year test with 170 trucks used in Los Angeles and is hoping to achieve spectacular results.
We're trying to see the effect of fuel parameters on emissions, in particular particulates and NOx and hydrocarbons. And we're partnering with engine people and after-treatment folks. These are people who produce filters and catalyst traps and various things like that. And they're working with us, and many of these vehicles will be retrofitted with those devices. And we hope to see some very significant reductions of pollutants by using diesel. In fact, we're even hopeful that with this after-treatment, we'll be able to approach or duplicate emission levels that are normally seen with alternative fuels like CNG and other type fuels.
It appears that new technology and tougher regulation will produce significant reductions in vehicle-generated air pollution over the next 10 years. This, in turn, could result in substantial health improvements, particularly in children, provided that increases in vehicle numbers and miles driven do not wipe out the gains. And now that the new century is officially here, we can reflect on what happened to the environment over the last 100 years. While the natural world suffered a lot of damage during the 20th century, from point and non-point source pollution, toxic and carbon emissions, and a host of other things, it wasn't all bad. In fact, throughout the century, presidents and the Congress have repeatedly taken action to protect and manage public lands. The Wilderness Society has compiled a list of some of these successes, and the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott takes a look.
The Wilderness Society has put together a dozen highlights of the 20th century. It's a list of some of the most significant land protection actions of the past 100 years, listed in chronological order. Topping the list is the creation of the first National Wildlife Refuge by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1903. Second is the passage of the Antiquities Act in 1906.
The Antiquities Act was a law passed by Congress that allows the president to be able to step in and protect certain public lands that are have some kind of imminent threat about them. The history of it results from vandalism and theft in the Anasazi ruins, the ancient cliff dwellings in the Southwest. And the Republican-controlled Congress back in 1906 passed the law authorizing the president to designate these sites that contain scientific, historic, or scenic treasures as national monuments and thus protect them.
That's Michael Francis, director of the National Forest Program for the Wilderness Society. He says number three on the list of land protection actions was the passage of the Weeks Act in 1911.
That's one of my favorites. The Weeks Act actually originated from a congressman in Massachusetts, and it was the creation of the Eastern National Forest. It was kind of a result of a lot of work by conservation in the northeastern United States and in West Virginia that brought about the protection of national of public lands in the eastern United States, actually the purchase and protection, I should say, the purchase and protection of lands in the eastern United States that make up the national forest system.
Also making the Wilderness Society's list was the creation of the National Park Service in 1916 and the defeat of the Echo Park Dam in 1956, which saved the Dinosaur National Monument. In 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed both the Land and Water Conservation Act and the Wilderness Act on the same day. The Wilderness Act created the National Wilderness Preservation System, which preserved some 9.1 million acres. Today it holds 104 million. The Land and Water Conservation Act established funding to preserve open space and develop recreation opportunities. The only non-government-related highlight listed is the first Earth Day, which occurred in 1970. Number 9 on the list is the passage of the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Again, Michael Francis.
That set up the standards that directs federal agencies to examine the impact of major federal actions, highways or any other kind of action, on the environment. And it establishes a citizen participation process in the sense that the environmental impact statements that were that are authorized by the law are a public document in which the public gets to comment on, and the government is required to put them out for comment and to review the comments, and they have to address those comments before they can take any kind of significant action that would hurt the environment.
Number 10 is the passage of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, followed by the National Forest Management Act in 1976. Francis says the last significant land protection action of the 20th century occurred with the approval of the Alaska Lands Act.
The passage of the Lands Act was probably the most significant public lands protection statute and acquisition since Gifford Pinchot and President Teddy Roosevelt added 80 million acres of land to the national forest system. The Alaska Lands Act was a culmination of over a decade of work by conservationists to protect the crown jewels of Alaska that were in the federal domain as of statehood. It was Mr. Carter's crowning achievement that his administration put the right political pressure in the right place and devoted the resources to the protection of national parks and wilderness areas in Alaska.
Michael Francis is optimistic as we enter the 21st century. He believes there has been a shift in the attitudes of the public, politicians, and of the Clinton administration toward conservation and preservation of natural areas. Even though there are some politicians who still want to gut the Endangered Species Act and reduce environmental protections, Francis generally believes that politicians are beginning to listen to the concerns of voters. For more information on the dozen 20th century highlights, go to the Wilderness Society's website at www.wilderness.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The audible environment is getting better from the east to the west. We welcome three new stations that are now carrying the show: WWIH FM in High Point, North Carolina, WJCU FM in Cleveland, Ohio, and KUNV FM in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We'd like to hear from you here on the Environment Show so we can broadcast your comment. Our telephone number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org.
Something in us loves a good storm. It forces our attention outside, away from the pull of televisions and computer terminals. It makes us aware of the natural world again. We seem to be a little hungry for it.
Whether it's a beach in the Caribbean or the street corner where the folks hang out, we all have places that are special to us. For author Jerry Dennis, it's northern Michigan, where a January snowstorm creates drifts taller than automobiles. In this portrait of place, Dennis reads from his book, The River Home, on anglers' explorations.
None of the storms of my experience can match the one my wife and I witnessed in 1977 when we were students at Northern Michigan University in Marquette, in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Marquette is on the shore of Lake Superior and gets 18 or 20 feet of snow each winter. When the wind is up, it charges from Ontario across 150 miles of open lake, throwing plumes of spray that laminate every surface with ice. It is a place shaped and colored by weather. Gail and I drove into Marquette for the first time on a bright January day when fog had slipped in from the lake and left everything it touched covered with a furry coat of rime. We rented an apartment a few blocks from downtown in an aging house we shared with three housemates. They were veterans of several Marquette winters. "Wait until it storms," they said. "You've never seen a blizzard until you've seen a Lake Superior blizzard." One morning a few weeks later, clouds moved in and the temperature climbed to the upper 20s, warmer than it had been in a month. All day the light was soft and strange. On television, the weatherman grinned and said, "Get ready, folks. It looks like we're in for a blinger." It was cause, of course, for a party. We telephoned friends and told them to bring food, drinks, and sleeping bags, then laced on our ice skates and sashayed down the middle of the street to the Red Owl supermarket, where we were met at the door by a weary manager who put up his hands and said, "Hey, hey, this ain't Skate World." Inside, we slid around the aisles in our stocking feet, loading a grocery cart with beer, chips, and frozen dinners, greeting everyone we met. Young people were animated and talkative, their eyes bright. Older folks acted the way they always acted. By the time we skated home with our bags of groceries, it had begun snowing. Hard pellets that sheared at angles, then dropped straight down and bounced along the street like excited molecules. The wind blew with so much force that our house swayed, causing the water in the toilet bowl to rise and fall. We turned up the music, made dinner, drank beer, and danced. We took turns going to the door to watch clouds of snow swirl down the street and eddy between the houses, building drifts that by morning would reach to the eaves. We switched off the lights and the wind came up louder than ever. It seemed to hoot at the pleasure of meeting obstacles. In the morning, all our windows were covered with elaborately patterned frost that fell in curls to the carpet when we scraped it with our fingernails. We breathed on the glass until face-size holes opened and we could look outside. The wind continued to blow, sweeping loose snow down the street. Trees looked shocked and naked. Telephone poles seemed bent in misery. Our neighbors' houses appeared deserted, their driveways filled with drifts that covered cars to their roofs. Someone turned on the radio, and an announcer said in a cheerful voice that the state police had blocked all highways out of the city and classes at the university were canceled. It was perfect. It was why we had come to Marquette, to be tested by extremes of nature, to watch the world throw tantrums. Staying warm in the midst of all that cold and wind made us feel capable and self-reliant and mildly heroic. We danced around the living room cheering for ourselves. We were brewing coffee and scrambling eggs when someone walked onto our porch and knocked. We opened the inner door, then pushed hard on the storm door to break through the drift that had built in front of it. A swirl of snow and cold came inside. Standing before us were two middle-aged women in snow-crusted coats, headscarves knotted tightly beneath their chins. They looked like Russian peasants dressed to go to the market. Behind them, snow roared down the street. The ladies smiled shyly. "We're collecting for the United Way," one of them said in the lilting Finnish accent of a native. My friends and I were flabbergasted. "Did you walk here?" we asked. "Yeah, down the street. It's our day for collecting." It was unthinkable to turn them away. We invited them inside and filled their donation envelopes with our pocket change. We offered them breakfast, but they couldn't stay. They had many houses to visit, they said, and because of the condition of the streets, they would have to do all their visiting on foot. They wanted to be finished in time to have supper ready when their husbands came home from work.
Jerry Dennis is author of the book, The River Home, An Angler's Explorations. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And now it's time for the Earth calendar. Thursday, January 20, will bring not only the first total lunar eclipse of the new century, but the first since 1997. A lunar eclipse occurs when the Earth passes between the Sun and the Moon, which causes the Earth's shadow to be cast on the Moon. Bob Berman, astronomer, author, and columnist for Discover magazine, says the eclipse will be visible throughout the United States.
If it's clear that night, you want to first notice that starting again at 1 minute after 10 in Eastern time, you'll see the edge of the shadow of the Earth. You'll notice that the strange shapes of the crescent that the Moon assumes during the next hour as the eclipse progresses. It goes through a very weird series of crescents, looking not at all like a normal crescent moon. And that's because the radius of curvature of the black bite that is taken out of the Moon is much larger than the Moon itself. As a matter of fact, Earth is 4 times the diameter of the Moon, but by the time our shadow gets that 250,000 miles to the Moon's distance, it's fallen off to half that size. So our shadow still is twice as large as the Moon. It's 4,000 miles across. The Moon is 2,000 miles across. So it's a ball that the Moon seems to be going into that's twice its size.
Berman says the eclipse will be in its totality at 11 p.m. Eastern on January 20 and will end about 20 after midnight. During a lunar eclipse, the shadow cast on the Moon is called the umbra. The outer fringe of the shadow is called the penumbra. Light passing through the Earth's atmosphere can vary in color and intensity when it is cast on the Moon. It depends on the clarity of the atmosphere. For example, the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines has altered the brightness of every eclipse since 1992 because of aerosols in the Earth's atmosphere. Bob Berman says it's too early to tell what will happen on January 20.
If there's a lot of clouds, it could turn grayish. If it's a lot of dust in the atmosphere, which we're not expecting, if they're either from pollution, from the fires that were in the Middle East some years back after the Gulf War or after a major volcanic eruption, you can have the Moon not only not turn reddish, but turn so darn dark that it actually vanishes during the eclipse. This time, a normal eclipse would show the Moon turning a coppery red. That would be its normal color. If the air is particularly clear, it might even be a yellow coppery red, just a bare darkening. So part of the excitement of a lunar eclipse is its unpredictability. We really don't know what the Moon will look like that night.
Primitive cultures must have had any number of theories about what caused the Moon to change color or disappear. However, as time went on, humans began to realize what was happening. Berman says the Moon is significant in part because it is the only object in the universe close enough to tell us something about the planet we're riding on.
In very primitive times, one might think that the Moon was being eaten into by some kind of curved monster. In truth, in ancient Greek times, the great thinkers realized that what this really was the best proof of all that we live on a round planet. There's not many opportunities for most of us to know that we live on a ball in space. We have to take other people's word for it, and that's why some of the flat Earth type people who think that the NASA space probes and photographs are all faked. Where really do we have an opportunity to tell that the Earth is round? Even in a passenger jet, the Earth still looks flat. It still looks like it might be a disk, but not round. Well, here's the occasion on Thursday night. Because the Moon goes into the spot of sky exactly opposite the Sun, and anyone could calculate that it's exactly opposite the Sun, and since anything casts its shadow at the spot opposite the Sun, we know that that darkening must be Earth's shadow. And what is the shape of that dark thing that the Moon is going into? It's round.
Members of the Flat Earth Society are hereby put on notice not to go outside under any circumstances before midnight on January 20. If you don't, your organization will undoubtedly thrive, at least until the next eclipse. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Thank you.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlin. Still ahead, Environment Show advisors with perspectives from government and the private sector assess the future. Technology, trade, climate change, and an increasing world population are having an impact on the planet. Can we be optimistic about the future? A green tip about where you can find out more about the environment where you live than you will ever want to know. And a report on the conditions of one of the kings of the beasts, the Asian tiger. There is some cause for hope. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Berlin. One of the things that I enjoy most about hosting the Environment Show is it gives me a chance to swap ideas with members of our advisory committee or advisory board, and three of them are with us today. And we will be discussing environmental challenges and issues that we face in the new century. With us are Langdon Marsh. He's Director of Environmental Quality for the State of Oregon. And I should say that in a previous incarnation, he was my deputy when I was Commissioner of Environmental Conservation of the State of New York, and later he became the commissioner. He is speaking to us from Portland. Also on the line from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, is Mary Lou Reed. She's former state senator in Idaho and a dedicated environmentalist. And from the East Coast, joining us is Jonathan Plout. He's former director of environmental quality for the Allied Signal Corporation, and he's former chairman, but now a member of the Joint Public Advisory Committee for the commission that was set up to deal with the environment under NAFTA. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should acknowledge that I am a member of the commission as well. And again, John Plout lives in New Jersey. Langdon Marsh, you are closer to the battle line, I think, than most of us, and perhaps you could just tick off some of the big issues that you're going to be struggling with as the new century begins.
Well, thank you, Peter. I picked out two overarching issues to talk about. One is the notion that technology having been manipulated to make a good bit of the mess that we've inherited from the 19th and 20th centuries, that we're going to need to have some major innovations in technology to help clean it up and prevent further problems in the future. And the second one is that we need to figure out how to work with ecosystems and not against them. And I think in both of these, I see a major global and a local role. I think the United Nations is going to have to step up to the plate and deal with some of the global atmospheric and destruction of natural resource issues over the next century. And I think we're also going to have to take account as individuals for a lot of the things we do as commuters and consumers of goods and managers of the little pieces of property around our house in order to contribute to the achieving some kind of sustainability over the next 20 to 50 years.
Well, Lang, that is the big picture, and we could spend all of our time on those. Mary Lou, what's on your list?
Well, I agree with everything that Lang said, and I think that the central issue has to be the sustainability of the planet in the coming century. With 6 billion people, that's such a significant number and more to come. So the impact of our machines is going to be very, very significant.
Okay, and John Plout, on top of your list.
Yes. First, I would say that I think that those were excellent lists that my two co-panelists mentioned. I would put them a little different way, although in some ways I would also repeat them. I think the issue which has haunted us now for a good deal of time and will haunt us in the next century is population. Some people say that the population growth is slowing. That might be so for the time being in terms of rates, but the fact is that we're still increasing very quickly in terms of numbers, and numbers, when we get over the 6 billion mark, begin to have even a greater impact on the world's environment. The second issue I would mention would be the need to face the fact that there needs to be a link between what you might call industrialization or world trade, or however you want to phrase that, and our environmental needs. And we've had a good deal of experience with that over the last couple of years on the NAFTA Commission, and I'd be happy to offer some perspectives on that if you like. And then, third of all, an issue which has also been alluded to, but I think by mid-century is going to be a very large issue for the whole globe, and that is climate change. And that issue is going to force a lot of changes in our behavior, but it is also going to make very clear to us, I think, the very important things that need to be done in terms of technology. If we're going to meet the climate change challenge, we are going to need new technologies which take the place of our present technologies, and that is a tremendous challenge for the globe over the next 50 years.
There are some themes that all of you mention one way or another. Population, obviously, is one. Technology is another. I recently saw a PBS special on 1900, and one of the things that talked about was how new technology was really revolutionizing America's view of itself and what where it was going. Langmarsh, do you see, since you raised it first, that technology is going to basically take us down a path to sustainability, or is it going to enable us to consume more voraciously and more destructively as time goes on?
I think in the present course, we're still aiming, even despite all of the efforts on energy conservation and so on, toward a more destructive course. But I think that technology isn't inherently bad. What we need to do is to harness new ideas, as has happened to a large extent in the information industry, but to apply that same very low input and very little waste philosophy to energy, manufacturing, and transportation industries. And we've got to do it pretty quickly. I think, you know, we've seen some good steps taken even this past Christmas season. The EPA announced further restrictions on fuels and cars to reduce emissions significantly. And that's good, but it's only a step toward producing a transportation system that is inherently waste-free. And that's going to take a lot of effort and time, as well as the production of energy and the manufacturing processes that we currently use need to be far less wasteful. I'm very impressed with the principles that the Swedes have come up with under the natural step, which essentially points us toward a situation where we don't use more energy than the globe can sustain, and that we reduce our resource consumption of, you know, natural products and products of the soil, as well as not introducing new and exotic chemicals into the ecosystem. I think those kinds of principles or similar ones need to be part of the fabric of every community, of every company, and eventually of every citizen.
Mary Lou, you raised the population issue, and I think one of the interesting things about that is that combines both technology questions as well as fundamental questions about life and well-being and education. One school of thought says we need a lot more technology, better birth control processes, chemicals, and so on. Others say this whole issue relates to women's education, economic opportunity, and so on, and we shouldn't get hung up on the technology. Where do you come out on that?
Well, I think I would say that we need both, and certainly a combination. I wish I could be as optimistic as Lang, but I think that somehow we have to get through to the whole issue of greed on the part of individuals and corporations and consumerism. And I don't see how we can continue on with our tremendous advances in technology unless we deal with the information that we're exchanging in a more reasonable fashion. And I don't know whether, you know, we can't really go back to blow up the TV, but certainly restrictions on advertising and, or at least ethical and intelligent approaches to advertising that recognize limits of the planet need to be incorporated. I do think one optimistic thing happened. I think that the, even though it was the collapse of the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle last month, the protest was a very wholesome one, in that it combined labor and environmental concerns over working conditions around the world and environmental standards around the world. And so I think if there can be more efforts made to recognize that free trade is not the same thing as fair trade, perhaps we can raise the boats without necessarily sinking the planet.
John Plout, you spend a lot of time thinking about the world trade situation, not only in your NAFTA capacity, but as the former senior executive in a multinational corporation post-Seattle. Where should the U.S. be going at this point? And I ask you that particularly because in a previous environment show, which we ran recently, I asked the U.S. Trade Representative's office, and they refused to comment. So they won't say where they're going.
Well, I'll try and say, Peter, where I think we should be going. I think that on the NAFTA Environmental Commission, we have seen that you can have a healthy link between what I would call responsible trade and environmental action. That link, of course, is spelled out in the earlier work at Rio, in the Rio Environmental Conference, and has been put into action in the NAFTA Commission. Not perfectly, but there has been good progress in terms of seeing where they can boost each other. Trade giving greater economic prosperity, as we've seen in the era of the 90s, with certain attendant problems, which were just mentioned. And on the other hand, if we can have good environmental action and then cooperation between the two, I think that points in the kind of direction we should go. But I think something else is needed. And we've seen that very clearly on the NAFTA Environmental Commission, and that is transparency. We need to be able to see through things so that we can have citizen involvement, citizen input. We can have differing views brought to the table, and we can see what the decision process is. And with that kind of transparency, which the Nobel Prize winner in 1998, Mr. Sen, said was absolutely essential to progress, with that kind of transparency and with cooperation between trade and the environment, I think there is a path that we can follow in the 21st century. And if I just might add, I also think that technology is neutral. It can be used positively or negatively. But you mentioned the year 1900, Peter, and I remember an editorial in the New York Times when we were moving towards the millennium saying that if you went back to 1900, you found the average life expectancies of people much lower and much less opportunity for people, including minorities and women. And part of the change that took place in the 1900s, part of the good change, there certainly were bad changes, was as a result of technology. And I think technology is going to play an even more important part in the 21st century.
Limarsh, as Director of Environmental Quality in the state of Oregon, you mentioned something that I thought was pretty interesting. You said we need to be able to work with ecosystems, implying that to date, to a large degree, we have not. How do we get a handle on that so that that becomes a way of doing business in the 21st century for people such as yourself and your colleagues in every state across the nation?
Peter, I think that one of the problems of the 20th century is that while we uncovered a great deal of knowledge about how we are harming the planet, we did not invest significantly or substantially enough in science to figure out how ecosystems really work. And I think that's changing now. And I think a worldwide investment strategy to help us figure out how, you know, what different species need for survival, how we can use ecosystems to manage our wastes, to do things like composting, sewage treatment, incorporation of non-toxic materials into soil, that kind of thing, to really be able to work with the systems so that we don't continually degrade them. I think that's a major scientific challenge of the 21st century.
With two folk from the Northwest with me, I've got to ask you whether the notions that Wang have been has been explaining will help save the salmon. Mary Lou, Wang, what do you think?
I think that if the government listens to the scientists, which I think is what Wang is saying, that there is a good chance of saving the salmon. I think that it does perhaps involve a major decision to undo some technology, the four dams and the lower snake, that man has put in and that need to be removed in order to make the river run like a river so the fish can swim. But there are some tremendously strong political, economic forces that are working against this. So I think that if science prevails, the fish will live.
Wang, in just a few moments remaining, can the Northwest salmon population, I know there are a number of them, survive the 21st century?
I'm optimistic that they can, Peter, because I think that there is a growing consensus that that is a value that people want in the Northwest, and that there is a growing scientific consensus that habitat improvement and other ways of assuring that the natural systems are duplicated as close as possible without necessarily taking out every dam in the system, those things will be done, and I'm optimistic that we'll learn enough over the next 20 to 50 years to save, if not all, at least most of the salmon runs.
I've been speaking with Environment Show Advisory Board members Langdon Marsh, Director of Environmental Quality from the state of Oregon, Mary Lou Reed, former state senator from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and Jonathan Plout, former director of environmental quality for the Allied Signal Corporation. You must have some ideas yourself about the environmental challenges in the 21st century, so share them with us. If they make sense, we'll broadcast them, and if they don't, we might broadcast them anyway. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime over the Internet. Go to our website, www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You can also hear us at www.wamc.org. That's www.wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Have you ever wondered about the toxic pollutants in your community, or the condition of ground and drinking water in your town, or how about the pounds or tons of each toxic chemical that is being released in your neighborhood, and the facility that's putting them there? The information is a mouse click away on a website set up by the Environmental Defense Fund, a national nonprofit organization. The site is www.scorecard.org. By filling in your zip code, you can get data about your community, how it ranks against national pollution indexes, health information about the toxics you're being exposed to, and suggestions about action to improve your local environment. The detail is impressive. Our farm is located in a community of less than 4,000 people, and yet the site reports that our county is ranked in the top 20% of all counties in the U.S. for cancer risk from hazardous air pollutants. U.S. EPA toxic release data shows the pounds of carcinogens coming from specific manufacturing plants and a college in the county. I was surprised to find toluene is the major toxic release in our air. You can find maps of your watersheds, information about agricultural runoff, details about health impacts of specific chemicals, and more than there is time to list here. Check out www.scorecard.org. That's www.scorecard.org. That's our green tip for this week. The tiger is now fighting for its very existence in Asia. That's the message from officials at the Wildlife Conservation Society based at the Bronx Zoo. 50 years ago, there were 8 tiger subspecies that roamed the continent. Today, only 5 remain. And experts say the world's tiger population has decreased by 95% over the last 100 years. But while the situation is serious, conservation officials say there are some positive steps that may save the majestic beast from extinction. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
Its distinctive orange and white colorings with black or brown stripes make the Asian tiger probably one of the most recognized of the world's big cats. And they are just as powerful as they are beautiful. Males can weigh more than 650 pounds and reach lengths of more than 10.5 feet. Females are a little smaller at around 8.5 feet long. They weigh 200 to 300 pounds. Years ago, they could be found in many regions of Asia.
They used to exist from the Caspian Sea in Central Asia down through India, across the entire southern part of the continent, through Sumatra, Java, Bali, in Indonesia, in the southern part of their range, and up to the Russian Far East and northern China. Now they've gone from the Caspian. They're extinct in Java and Bali. They're holding on pretty well in Sumatra, but it's a big island with lots of protected areas. And they're now found scattered throughout the rest of their former range. They're pretty much, I won't say extinct in China, but certainly the South China populations are either extinct or nearly so. And the tigers that you find in northern China are migrants that have moved over from the Russian Far East, where the last good population of Siberian or Amur tigers remain.
That's Josh Ginsberg, director of the Asia Program for Wildlife Conservation Society, based at the Bronx Zoo. He says researchers are not really sure exactly how many tigers remain in Asia today. Counting them is difficult because the animals are nocturnal and usually live in dense forests. But the best estimates are between 5 and 7,000. Ginsberg says there are several factors contributing to their decline.
The recent declines, so the declines in the last, say, 30 or 40 years, have been driven not just by habitat loss, but by two other factors. The first of which is loss of prey. And I think this is one of those factors that is greatly underestimated. So in many areas, tigers go extinct because people like to eat the same things that tigers do. People like to eat deer, they like to eat pigs, and tigers like to eat deer, and they like to eat pigs. And so there's direct competition for food between human populations and tiger populations. The second thing that's endangering tigers is poaching of tigers directly for their bones, for their body parts, for the medicinal trade in China.
Decades ago, some wildlife officials predicted that the tiger would be extinct by the year 2000. Ginsberg says the good news is that wild populations are still with us. The bad news is they are not increasing in numbers either. He attributes the holding pattern to various international efforts targeted at saving the tiger, some of which have occurred in countries that previously offered few protections.
A good example of that is the Russian Far East. When we started working with the Hornocker Wildlife Institute in the Russian Far East in 1989-1990, the question was, will tigers survive? There was a lot of poaching. Russian Far East borders China, it borders Korea. Those are two of the major markets for tiger parts. The Russian Far East at that point was the Soviet Union, and it was under a lot of stress, and eventually, of course, the Soviet Union broke up, and that led to even greater uncertainty because the rule of law started to disappear. And when we started the project, the question was, will tigers survive for 5 years? Well, populations there have stabilized. We think they may have increased. Poaching is still a problem, but there are some on-the-ground efforts supported by a group called Operation Amba, which is a semi-autonomous tiger anti-poaching unit. There's a lot more research on tiger distribution and tiger needs. There's a lot of work going into designating protected areas for tigers, recovering prey. We're working with local hunting associations because their goal is to increase the amount of wild boar and deer available for their hunters. Of course, if you do that, it has a positive benefit for the tigers.
In addition, the Law of the Russian Federation on Environmental Protection and Management of 1992 gave the Amur tiger legal protection, even though the financial crisis in Russia has put limits on the amount the country can spend on protecting the endangered cat. Some say India, which holds close to two-thirds of the world's tiger population, is the best hope for tiger survival. In the past 30 years, the government has banned tiger shooting and established more than 22 tiger reserves. Overall, Ginsberg believes the animal has a chance of surviving if the problems of habitat loss and poaching continue to be addressed.
Tigers left to their own with good food can double their populations in the course of 4 or 5 years. So if you've got a small nucleus of a tiger population and you've got a healthy prey base, the tigers themselves will recover.
Ginsberg also says financial support by various entities contribute to his optimism.
I think the future for tigers will depend a lot on the actions that we take in the next 5 or 10 years. I think the fact that the Exxon Corporation, for instance, has committed $1 million a year to tigers for the last 6 years and is going to continue that commitment, I hope, for the foreseeable future. The fact that the U.S. government has made a commitment to tiger conservation is really, really important because it provides a stable core funding. We could always use more money, but stable money is better than huge influxes of money and then disappearing funding for these programs.
In general, Ginsberg believes that what has happened to the tiger is symbolic of what is happening across Asia. That is, as developing countries continue to strive for economic prosperity and better living, natural resources are depleted, which affects the balance of ecosystems and the stability of wildlife like the tiger. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berlet. A new clean-burning SUV will let you battle the storms in Michigan, all without affecting the reflected light from Earth during the next lunar eclipse. Another alternative is to order this show, number 524, at 1-800-323-9262, and listen again in your old SUV while it's parked in your driveway with the motor turned off. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.